This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Ecologist and author Sandra Steingraber's most recent book is Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Steingraber will read from that book tomorrow night at Kalamazoo College. She's currently a scholar in residence at Ithaca College in New York. Sandra Steingraber, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Something I did not mention in the beginning that people will find in any biography of you online is that you're a cancer survivor. You had bladder cancer at a young age. Did that change how you viewed the world around you and influence the path that you took in terms of writing and ecology?
It did. And I would say that in that way, it makes me no different than any other cancer patient. I think any cancer diagnosis is like a big cane coming in to the stage of one's own life and kind of pulling you off stage. If my case is untypical at all, it's because I was so young. I was in between my sophomore and junior year of college, so I was at that stage of life where big decisions are being made anyway about what one's going to study and what one's career path is. And so for me, who was a high-achieving biology major on my way to medical school, I suddenly realized that I didn't want the hospital to be my workplace anymore. Knowing that I was going to be a cancer patient and spending plenty of time in the backless blue cotton gown hooked up to IV drips anyway. And I should say that bladder cancer, of all human cancers, is the one most likely to recur. It has a good survival rate. It's not the worst cancer to be diagnosed with, but 70% of all patients have a recurrence, and so one leads a highly medicalized life. And so it made me decide to go into biological research instead of medical school. And in addition, my own diagnosing physician began asking me questions about my childhood environmental exposures while I was still lying there exhaling anesthesia. Some of them had to do with I worked in an aluminum smelter. Well, no, I hadn't, but I actually grew up not far from one. And so his questions rightly directed my line of inquiry as a young biologist down a path of asking what kind of environmental exposures might be the explanation for my situation. And then lastly, I brought another part of my identity to bear in all this, and that I'm adopted. So my mother actually was already diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer when I was diagnosed with bladder cancer, and we became co-cancer patients together. Then my aunt went on to die of the same kind of bladder cancer that I had. But knowing I was adopted meant that I began to realize how, in our culture, many people, including my own doctors, presume that what ran in families necessarily runs in genes, and saw family cancers as hereditary cancers rather than maybe cancers of shared exposure. And so essentially then the relationship between human health and environmental health became my life's work, and I've now written a trilogy of books on that connection.
And as you say, your cancer came very early in life. 20 years old is not when we hear of a lot of people getting cancer. Are more of us probably being exposed to something and then taking decades before that cancer gets diagnosed?
Well, there is data to suggest that. And so the book that I closely look at the relationship between environmental exposure and risk of cancer is my book, Living Downstream. And so for me, it's kind of two books in one. I went back to my hometown, a highly industrialized area along the Illinois River, and began an investigation of the kinds of chemicals that I knew from research were associated with bladder cancer to see what I could find. And so it didn't take too much sleuthing around to discover that I was just actually one data point in a cluster of cancers there. The cancer rate is significantly above average where I grew up. And then I began to look at what was in drinking water, had to file Freedom of Information Act requests and so forth. And so essentially, I tried to pull together two different databases that we dutifully collect, but no one routinely builds bridges between. One is the cancer registry data, which is a sort of a moving picture of the cancer trends over time and how cancer clusters itself over geographic space. And that's our cancer registry data. That's all collected by the cancer registrar in the public health departments of every state. And then, in addition, every state of the union keeps toxics release inventory data. This is actually gathered by our US EPA. And it's gathered by a zip code. And so you can actually see where the toxic releases are and what the cancer rates are. It's just that it's not a lot of research is being done to try to bring those two together. So that's what I try to do with Living Downstream, not only for my own hometown, which is the kind of narrative of the book, is my own cancer diagnosis and my own little community, and then you see me as a cancer patient going back to ask that question that all cancer patients ask, why me? But I ask it in this very biological way.
In your book, Raising Elijah, you introduce a term called well-informed futility. Explain what this means.
Yeah, that's the opening concept of the book, I would say, in Raising Elijah. And I wanted that to be my starting place because I had already at that point written a couple of books laying out the evidence for a link between, we've been talking about cancer in the environment, but the book after that, I actually look at pregnancy and look at risk for miscarriages and learning disabilities, birth defects, and so on. Those are really scary topics for people. And so what I began to realize is that our inability to actually look at this evidence, we turn away from it reflexively. It seems depressing and overwhelming, and we don't really want to know. And why is that? Why is it we can't take a look at this? And so one of my readers actually introduced me to the work of a German psychologist who had this concept that he had done some theorizing and research about called well-informed futility. And for him, it referenced not the environmental crisis, but rather a phenomenon in the 1960s in which people who watched a lot of television news on the Vietnam War were less likely to take action. And there's something about seeing these horrible pictures, which at the time, of course, the Vietnam War was the first war really televised in what we would call real time now, but is pretty close to it. And instead of galvanizing people, it had the opposite impact. So the psychological idea is basically this, that whenever there's a human problem over which we feel no agency, like we can't imagine that anything we could do to solve that problem, then we begin to feel unbearable feelings. It compels us to turn away from any more knowledge about that topic because we can't bear those feelings. And so I wanted to resurrect that idea because I felt it had currency and meaning for our current age. Here we are in the midst of basically two twin crises. First is, of course, what we've been talking about, which is this crisis of toxic contamination, contamination without consent. So our bodies end up being the repository of inherently toxic chemicals that we know, we have good data to show they alter our immune status, they can interfere with our hormones, they can break our chromosomes and raise the risk for cancer and so on. And then the other crisis, of course, is the climate crisis. And here we are hurtling toward a climate cliff now. We're at the point where we're beyond every little bit helps in terms of doing small things to get us on the right path to pull us back from calamity. And now we're at the, you know, the last straw that breaks the camel's back point, and where we need to do huge changes to our energy system very rapidly and decarbonize as quickly as possible. And yet we're still not on wartime footing with this. We're not walking around having endless conversations at every coffee shop, at every dinner table, with every elected official about what we're going to do here. We're just unable to really look at the square in the eye. So I felt like until we deal with this phenomenon of well-informed futility and the way it creates a kind of existential paralysis in our hearts and in our political system, we're just not going to find the determination and resolve to go forward.
Do we have to accept less convenience in some ways that we've come to expect in modern life in exchange for cleaner air and water and fewer health risks?
No, just the opposite, I would say. And here's where the good news begins. I mean, there's a few pieces of good news. So let me, and you just hit on one of them. Let me just articulate the other. You know, if I thought that cancer, for example, was simply in this inherited problem, that we inherited bad cancer genes and they just exploded at random and there was nothing we could do about that, that would be truly depressing. But instead, what the evidence shows us is that a large proportion of cancers are actually attributable to the things that people put into the environment, either chemicals or the way the built environment is created, forcing people, for example, to commute long distances behind diesel trucks and lead a sedentary life. Those are the kinds of things that explain the lion's share of cancers. And given that evidence, we as people can alter what we put into the environment and how we create a built environment. And likewise, I think that the evidence is that should we move forward with innovations in green chemistry and green energy, that our lives simply get better, that there's a convenience in, for example, not being plunged into the cold and the dark every time there's a windstorm because a tree falls down on a power line. And it's amazing to me that our energy system is stuck in a kind of time capsule. I mean, the rest of the world moves on with this amazing innovation, and yet we're still shoveling coal into an oven and lighting it on fire. So in other words, we carry around now whole libraries in our pocket. We store data in iCloud, and yet we still power these devices by blasting fossil fuels out of the ground and torching them. And that hasn't changed for 150 years. And so liberating, I think, investments in renewable energy, which are being held hostage, I think, by the fossil fuel industry, is really what I'm interested in. And that's what I'll talk about when I'm in Michigan, because I think the road to meaningful chemical reform also runs through our energy policy, because so much of the chemicals that I worry about as a biologist and their ability to expose people, and then second, create demonstrable health risks, those are chemicals that are brought to us because we build our materials economy out of the leftovers and the waste products from our energy system. In other words, we have coal ash in cement and in the walls of our homes because we have all this coal ash left over. We have plastic bags in a large part because the fracking industry not only blasts bubbles of methane out of our bedrock, but what comes up with the methane is also other hydrocarbons like ethane, and they don't know what to do with it. So we're going to build ethylene crackers now and make more plastic and more fertilizers and more pesticides, not because there's a human need for these things necessarily, but because it's value added for the energy industries.
Now, you brought up fracking. The defenders of fracking will say that natural gas is cleaner than oil or coal, and that the most of the solution which is used for fracking is water and sand. You've been a very vocal opponent of fracking. How come?
I see fracking as the mother of all of our problems right now in the U.S. in terms of the environmental crisis, because it is what is going to continue the fossil fuel party long after we should be declaring it over. And further investments in fossil fuels are essentially ruinous and unethical at this point. And just to speak substantively, fracking is, and the natural gas it produces can only be called clean energy in the narrowest of sense, meaning that if you compare natural gas to coal, when you light it on fire, it produces only half of the carbon dioxide that coal produces. However, two things. One, we're so far down the climate road now that simply swapping out natural gas for coal is not going to save us from climate catastrophe. That's not just me saying that. That is international bodies that have looked at climate change. So it's not clean enough compared to coal. Coal should not be the benchmark. And second, when you back up and you include a whole life cycle analysis of the carbon footprint of natural gas via fracking, what you see is that there are so many leaks of methane, which that's what natural gas is, all along the system at every stage, from the moment the drill bit goes into the ground, from the compressor stations, the pipelines, the gas that flows under our cities and so forth. There are all these natural gas leaks all along the way. A recent publication in Science magazine, which is one of our premier journals in the field of, across the sciences, demonstrates that a natural gas power plant, once you factor in the fugitive methane leaks, is not cleaner than coal for somewhere up to 60 or 70 years. So the difference is that natural gas methane is more potent at trapping heat, but doesn't last as long as carbon dioxide. So during the first few years or decades, a natural gas power plant is actually worse than coal, and it only becomes better if you factor in a time frame of about 100 years. But the climate scientists tell us we don't have 100 years to solve this problem. We only have maybe a decade at most. And then in addition, there are all these toxic problems created by fracking, which basically turns the earth inside out, introduces inherently toxic chemicals into the environment. Fracking creates air pollution wherever it goes. And we know that the well casings themselves, that which transverse our drinking water aquifers, are not impervious forever. And so now we've threatened our source of drinking water, too. So the price is too high for fracking. And it, more than anything else, it continues the addiction that we have to fossil fuels and prevents us from leaping into renewables.
One last thing I want to ask you about is PCB contamination. People in the city of Kalamazoo are awaiting word from the Environmental Protection Agency about cleaning up a Superfund site here. What does living near that contamination do to people?
Well, we know a lot about PCBs here in New York State, which is where I live now, so I'll be talking about this, actually. The Hudson River is likewise contaminated with PCBs. So PCBs are kind of the Methuselah, if you will, of hydrocarbon molecules. They were originally synthesized from coal tar, and they last a long time in the environment. And they're semi-volatile, meaning that they'll evaporate, but not as rapidly as water. And so when these chemicals in a cold area like Michigan or New York begin to volatilize from soil, or in our case, in the Hudson River sediments, they end up kind of going into the air. It's cold. Their condensation point is reached. They come back down, and they can then insinuate themselves up the food chain. So we're mostly exposed by eating food. And because they're fat, they're soluble in fat, they end up in fatty animal products at their highest concentrations. And PCBs were outlawed in 1976, and I think they're a good model for what we should do with fracking. When we decide that a technology is inherently unmanageable and we pay too high of a cost, we simply outlaw them. That's what we did with PCBs. That's what we did with smoking and airplanes. That's what we should do with fracking. So we've learned a lot more about PCBs since we've outlawed them. And that's the model I'm going to talk about with fracking, that yes, we need more scientific study on fracking, but you don't keep people in harm's way while the fracking is going on. And similarly with the whole tar sands experiment. So, I mean, I see Kalamazoo as a really important place to have this conversation, because it's a place that has already experienced the largest spill of Canadian tar sands in the United States in the Kalamazoo River. We also have the example of PCBs in the area. And then Western Michigan is also in the crosshairs of the gas industry for fracking. So PCBs, tar sands, fracking, these will all be part of the conversation that I want to have in this place. And I can see no better place to have it than in Kalamazoo.
Sandra Steingraber, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Ecologist and author Sandra Steingraber will read from her most recent book, Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis, tomorrow night at Kalamazoo College. Her talk begins at 8 o'clock in the Light Fine Arts Dalton Theater. Steingraber's appearance is part of the Changing Climate series, sponsored by Western Michigan University's Center for the Humanities. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at WMUK.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.